You have three pairs of pants on tonight, you know, in honor of our episode about all threes.
I have three pairs of pants.
Or three-legged pants?
No, no, no. I'm not Eric's.
Okay. This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 33 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Zachary Frueling, and with me today is Mike Morrison. Well, in honor of our 33rd episode, All Threes, we're going to be talking about the TNG episode Cause and Effect and the metaphysics of time and time travel paradoxes today. Mike, welcome to the show.
Hello, Zachary.
How are you today?
I'm three times better always when I'm podcasting.
33 times better in honor of our 33rd show. All threes, Mike. All threes. Didn't you watch that episode?
I did.
I feel like we've done this. I know this is an old joke, but I feel like we've done this before. Are you getting a sense of deja vu as we're talking about cause and effect?
Yeah, but I just thought it was because I'm three sheets to the wind.
33 sheets to the wind.
33 sheets to the wind.
That's how you podcast.
I got my Earl Grey in my Star Trek mug. That's all. I promise.
All right. Just double checking.
Little shot of honey to sweeten it up a little bit. I don't spike it. No sorry in brandy here.
More's the pity. Well, I was thinking, Mike, that, you know, this is episode 33 and you only have one shot to do this, right? The next episode where we would have all threes is episode 333. And we're not going to wait that long to talk about time travel and time paradoxes and the metaphysics of time. So I figured while it's episode 33, we better get the TNG episode Cause and Effect on the agenda and do our long promised time travel and metaphysics of time episode. For quite a long time now, several months, we've sort of promised that we're going to do an episode on time travel and time paradoxes and the metaphysics of time. Here we are. We're finally going to do it. Episode 33, all threes.
Yeah. And again, I'm glad you mentioned we have promises to our listeners. I have to admit, though, as much as I like a good time travel episode, I tend to be a little less versed on physics and, you know, these sort of time paradoxes. So I'm at a bit of a disadvantage here. But my advantage is I do love the time travel episodes. I enjoy it. It doesn't matter to me whether it's the Guardian of Forever or an Atavacron or whether you're using Q powers or a black hole or a temporal vortex or a temporal rift or a temporal distortion or a time shift. It doesn't matter. The orb of time, I'll take it all. I love time travel episodes.
Would you like an episode, a time travel, it's not even a time travel story. Would you like a time-based Star Trek story where basically time gets frozen and it's 40-something minutes of the same frame? Like the episode is paused for 45 minutes?
That sounds like fanfic there, Zachary.
It'd be a very short fanfic. There'd only be one scene in it.
Well, I mean, you raised $10 and this is... You've got one frame for 40 minutes. And then at the end, you break loose and you film a, you know, a 3-second, oh, glad to be free from that. And there you have it.
See, that sounds like something the suits, the executives would think of. You know, we need to save a little money on the next episode of Star Trek. I have an idea. Let's do a time story where we just, you know, time gets frozen. And we do the we basically show the same scene for 45 minutes. And that's, you know, kind of what they do with Cause and Effect, right? You know, it's there, you know, the crew of the Enterprise is stuck in a time loop, and you know, where the same scenes are repeated, but they're not as you know, uninspired as doing the exact same scenes over and over again, or being, you know, paused on the same scene. At least you get a little variation with each time loop, but you know, that'd be a great way to save some money.
Yeah, from the perspective of production, I've got to hand it to them to be able to show the same scene from different vantage points, different perspectives. I found that to be quite interesting. I'm really glad that they just didn't play the same scene over and over. That would have gotten old. But even if we're slingshotting around the sun, I'm all there. I love time travel episodes.
Well, I'm particularly fond of this episode because at this point, you know, Star Trek had done time travel in a few different ways. You've already had yesterday's Enterprise. You've had Star Trek IV going back in time. Right. So, you know, some of the usual ways of telling time travel stories had been done. So at that point, you know, given that they'd kind of fleshed out the usual time travel stories, you know, from a writing dramatic standpoint, you just have to decide, you know, how can we tell a time travel story in a different kind of way that hasn't been done before? You know, otherwise, because you don't just want to tell like the Back to the Future paradox again and again and again, right? You know, I don't want to see Captain Picard's mother falling in love with Captain Picard, right? That we saw that in Back to the Future. I don't need to see that again. So you gotta give this episode credit for trying to tell a time-based story in a unique way, something that hadn't really been done before. And it was creative in its own way. I think it's easy to forget how, I don't think anyone had seen anything quite like this when this episode came out.
No, indeed. And we were talking in the Turbo Lift, this particular story has its problems. And, you know, quite honestly, I think there are some things about the episode that just didn't jive with me personally, and the mechanics were a little difficult. I know we were talking about the time bubble, the causal loop, but I got to say it was a unique way to tell a time travel story. You know, the fact that they were caught in this causal loop and basically frozen in time for all intents and purposes, this one particular day. You know, there they are, they're frozen in time, and how they're able to carry the memories that they had forward into the next loop. And for instance, you know, Beverly remembering the cards that were dealt and remembering Geordi's headache, and Riker remembering that Beverly was going to call him on the bluff. I thought that was pretty interesting, and it raises a lot of really fun questions as well.
Well, you were telling me before we started recording the show today that you had a little trouble understanding the time mechanics of this episode, how 17 days can pass, you know, in normal space while the same day is repeating itself, you know, with again and again and again inside this causal loop, and they end up out of sync, and they check the chronometer and the chronometer's off, and that didn't really add up in your mind. And I think what I love about this episode is that it asks an awful lot of the viewers.
Oh, yes.
You know, this is a pretty cerebral episode. You know, it's not as cerebral as The Cage, but, you know, this, in terms of Star Trek stories, I think this one demands a lot. You know, if you're not keeping up with the weirdness that's going on, you're either going to be confused, or you're going to think something's, you know, broken, like they're repeating the feed over and over again. In fact, I remember hearing an anecdote that, you know, when this episode first aired, some people actually called into their TV show or TV stations saying, hey, I think you're repeating the same episode again and again. Something's broken. I'm getting the same episode. And so my apologies to anyone who actually did that. I didn't mean to poke fun at you, but my point is just that this demands a lot. You know, this is taking, you know, some weirdness about space-time and temporal mechanics and putting it in a Star Trek setting, and it's not exactly clear what the drama is or how they're going to get out of the situation. You know, halfway through the episode, you could still be totally confused about what's going on. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing that this episode didn't lose a lot more viewers, I think, than it did. I mean, it's to Star Trek's credit, you know, its ability to take a very... you know, esoteric concept, like, you know, space-time mechanics, and write a story where the drama is largely centered around that, that weirdness, you know, Brandon Braga's weird stuff, as we've joked around, and build and make that the structure of the episode and expect, you know, your average viewer to keep up. I think it shows that Star Trek, and its creators have a lot of faith in the mental and rational abilities of their viewership, that, you know, people will keep up if you tell the right kind of story and present it in the right kind of way, whether or not you understand the physics or the philosophy.
Well, and surprise, surprise, this was written by Brandon Braga.
I knew that one. Yeah.
I tend to have a very keen eye for the production points in a story. So I wasn't really caught off guard by the fact that they were repeating it over and over and over again, because, again, I think they did a really good job of looking at this causal loop from different vantage points. I'm really glad, to be quite honest with you, that we didn't get the opening sequence over and over again, because I can only watch Riker with his leg propped up on the console, you know, falling and getting a full spread eagle only so many times. I'm glad we got to see that from different vantage points, because that wasn't enjoyable for me.
You know, I mean, I know we want to talk about the philosophy of this episode for sure, but
sure.
Before we do that, I love seeing the Enterprise blow up. You know, it's like in Star Trek III when you saw the original Enterprise.
There's,
you know,
a shock
explode.
Factor to it, isn't there?
There is, because there's going to be a way out of the situation, especially when you open an episode like that. That's not going to be the end result. They're going to fix the situation somehow. But you sure don't expect that. They don't blow up the Enterprise every episode. And if you did that, you'd really overuse it.
And definitely not in the opening sequence.
And I think that made a huge impact. This has been one of my favorite episodes for a long time. It's not the deepest episode. I think, you know, from a philosophy standpoint, it may be even a little light on the philosophy of time, frankly. But it is one of my favorite episodes. I think the pure shock factor of seeing the Enterprise blow up, the weirdness of experiencing the same day again and again, wondering why it unfolds differently if they're genuinely stuck in a causal loop. I kind of wonder why it unfolds differently every time, frankly. And so there are parts of it that don't make sense, but it's so interesting and fun. It's a fun conundrum to work your way out of. And you really don't understand what's going on. I'm putting myself back in what it was like to watch this episode the first time around. I think I probably didn't understand what was going on 2/3 of the way through the episode. And yet it was so captivating of a story, even though I was totally confused. And I find that paradox really interesting.
Again, I really enjoyed the episode from the storytelling standpoint. As you and I have already mentioned, I did find some problems, at least some things that just for me were questionable about the mechanics of the time travel story that they were telling. The fact that they were able to tell this story, this causal loop, and it was fresh, it was different, it was, in my opinion, 3 times better than Times Squared. And 33 times better than Times Squared. One of the better time travel, but it is, you're right, Zachary, it is light on the time travel aspect. One of the things I really appreciate about the end solution to this problem that they had was the discovery that sometimes the best, most logical course of action isn't always going to be the right one, because I don't think anyone would argue, and certainly Jean-Luc Picard on the bridge of the Enterprise D did not argue. You know, Will gives his recommendation. Let's blow a hatch. Let's decompress the shuttle bay. Data says no. You know, let's put a tractor beam on the Bozeman, and Picard didn't even question it. Yes, absolutely, make it so. But that was the most logical. It seemed like the right course of action, but we saw over and over and over again for 17 days that this was not the right course of action. This was actually the wrong course of action. And so to me, philosophically, that's my big takeaway from it. The mechanics of time travel in this particular episode, a little bit light. We'll talk a lot about cause and effect, but there are about 51, if you include the movies, 51 time travel episodes, if you will, within the Star Trek universe. That includes the animated series. We got Yesteryear, which was a time travel episode. The original series actually gave us the fewest time travel episodes. So there's actually, Zachary, a pretty good mind for us to work here when we're talking about time travel. And I'm sure we'll weave some of these other threads into the conversation as well.
I had no idea there were so many time travel episodes. I never bothered to count them, frankly. And if I had to guess, I would have guessed something like 20 or 25 episodes tops, but 51 episodes, give or take, huh?
Yeah, it's pretty phenomenal. Again, if you include the movies and the animated series, it's fascinating.
I think one of the things I like about this time travel story in particular in Cause and Effect is the way in which it really does rely on a more contemporary notion of what time is. Mm-hmm. You know, oftentimes these time travel stories are frankly too linear. You know, they think of time as just kind of measured out in even quantities, and you can jump back in time and you affect something there, and then time just keeps marching on, and it's very Newtonian and linear. And here you get an interesting take on the idea of space-time, the idea that space and time are related, and in fact the same thing, that there's a relationship between them and that they're malleable, and different regions of space can have different rates of time. And you know, the Enterprise gets stuck in this temporal loop because they're in this region of space where time is somehow repeating itself. Mm-hmm. But you know, the end result is that 17 days go by out, you know, in normal space, while you know they're repeating the same day, and time is essentially, because of the end result of that, is that time is moving at a different rate. And I just find that idea fascinating, because it's, you know, oftentimes I just think these time travel stories are too Newtonian. They don't sort of try to find an interesting way to incorporate the idea that space and time are related, and they're malleable, and they can move at different rates, and they're affected by things. So if you put all that together and say, okay, how can we write a time travel story around that, you know, using this contemporary notion of space-time, this relativistic notion we get from Einstein's general theory of relativity, how can we write a story around that? And this episode seems like an interesting take on a time travel story that is respectful of the contemporary view coming from Einstein's theory of relativity about space-time.
Yeah, and I think if anybody can do it, it is the extremely talented writers that have been pulled in over the years to write for Star Trek, because you have to go beyond a good character story. You have to go beyond, you know, a plot line that works, and, you know, individual little plot points that work. And you've got to go beyond those things. You've got to go beyond in terms of action and dialogue. You've got to go beyond those things and really write in with a particular understanding of the physics and metaphysics of time. And that's not an easy thing. I said at the top of the episode today that this is something that's not really my forte. I don't think that I could sit down and write a really well-crafted cerebral time travel story. I know the basics, Zachary, but to really get into the nuts and bolts and mechanics of it, like they do oftentimes in Star Trek, it's a very difficult thing to do. So it takes a special kind of writer who has some principal grasp on these concepts, in addition to understanding dialogue and character interaction and plot points and so on and so forth.
I like the way you put the way you described time a minute ago. You basically said the physics and the metaphysics of time. And that's a good segue into our discussion about the philosophy of time, because in most areas in philosophy, especially in metaphysics, in fact, the very name metaphysics means beyond physics, right? Mm-hmm. Things that are beyond the scope of what you can evaluate or measure empirically. You know, things that are postulated to explain the empirical world, but can't be explained by the empirical world. But with the metaphysics of time, you get a really interesting synergy of physics and metaphysics, because it's not at all clear what time is, first of all. It's an inherently abstract concept. And so as physics tries to, you know, I think go further and further in explaining what time is, moving beyond the things that can be empirically verified, postulating other kinds of entities to explain how the mechanics of time in this very abstract mathematical sense, there's a lot more overlap with what you get in metaphysics, the types of entities and explanations you get in metaphysics to explain time. I think both physicists and philosophers have the same goal in mind when they're trying to explain what time is, and physicists I think are not nowadays are not limiting themselves to purely empirical descriptions of what time is. They're more than willing to entertain weird ideas like four-dimensionalism, the extra dimensions to explain time, or the idea that the future exists in some, you know, membrane stretched out in space-time in some way that, you know, we can't see in the present, but is really there in mm-hmm. some way. These really abstract postulated ideas are not dismissed in contemporary physics purely because they're abstract. You know, so theoretical physics is open to those kinds of abstract abstractions. And of course, metaphysics, you know, from the beginning of time has dealt with postulated entities to explain features of the world of experience. So there's a really interesting synergy of physics and metaphysics with the philosophy of time, way more so than you get in almost any other area in philosophy, I think.
Yeah, and I think you're exactly right. David Deutsch, who is a physicist, said, quote, "I myself believe that there will one day be time travel, because when we find that something isn't forbidden by the overarching laws of physics, we usually eventually find a technological way of doing it," end quote. I think a generation ago, David Deutsch would have said something like that and probably would have been branded a heretic and probably completely laughed out of the scientific world. But he can say something like that now because we are discovering things on a exponential level, unlike we were in any other time. You know, when Einstein theorizes about relativity, and now we're actually exploring the sciences that are well on their way to taking that theory and making it something provable, quantifiable. I think we're living in pretty phenomenal times.
Well, I think there's still a fundamental difference between the way physics and philosophy deals with time, even though there's a lot of overlap and the goal is essentially the same, to explain why it seems like there's a movement through time. How could that be possible? The goal is the same, but the methods are still a little different. Even though physicists are willing to entertain postulated entities and abstractions to explain time, their goal is still to try to bring all those things into the realm of what's empirically verifiable. Mm-hmm. So things like Einstein's general theory of relativity, you know, that when it was first postulated, there were sort of in principle things you could verify, but there was no practical way to verify things, you know, these simple things that the general theory of relativity postulated, like the fact that gravity, the presence of matter in space-time bends space-time, so light travels in a curved path. You know, that was an abstraction. Until they realize that during an eclipse, you can see, observe the movement of stars bending around the sun during an eclipse. So there were these in principle, predictable, empirically verifiable predictions you could make. And that's what puts those kinds of ideas firmly in the realm of science, I think, mm-hmm. As opposed to the kinds of postulated entities you get in sort of pure abstract metaphysics of time. I mentioned four-dimensionalism, this idea that the past and the future are both spread out in some other dimension,
yes,
so that they all exist and somehow we're moving through the present. The present keeps moving along this membrane. You still have to kind of explain how that works. But that's something that's inherently outside of the realm of what's happening in time. That's like stepping outside of time altogether, almost like a God's eye point of view, as if you weren't inside the universe looking at it from the outside. If you could step outside space-time and say, okay, wait, the past and the future are all spread out and in this nice orderly fashion, mm-hmm. That's a great metaphysical explanation of time, but that has no empirical consequences, things you could verify inside that membrane, inside space-time. So that kind of explanation is more along the lines of pure abstract metaphysics, because it doesn't seem to have any, even in principle, empirically verifiable consequences. So there's still a conceptual distinction between how physics and philosophy deals with those kinds of explanations. But the history of science shows that some of the things that start out as abstractions, when they're analyzed further and the theories get more fleshed out, can lead to empirically verifiable consequences that you can then go out and research and do experiments on. And just because something looks like an abstraction at first doesn't mean that eventually it won't move inside the realm of pure science, where you can, predict some empirically verifiable predictions that you can go out and research. The history of science just shows that is not the things that look like philosophy sometimes can move into the realm of the verifiable sciences. So there's still a distinction, but there's an awful lot of overlap, and definitely physics and philosophy have the same goals when it comes to trying to analyze what time is.
Oh, definitely. I think about Einstein, and needs no introduction, the greatest theoretical physicist of all time.
Except he was wrong.
On some things, but
you can still be the greatest and be wrong.
You can
I love
still
that
be the
Einstein.
Greatest and be wrong. Absolutely. He referred to the distinction between the past, the present, and the future as, quote, only a stubbornly persistent illusion. And, we take a statement like that, and we basically break down the walls, as it were, of linear time. And then we take a concept like that and we put it into Star Trek Deep Space Nine. And we explain it in terms of the wormhole aliens who exist out of time. And, you know, Sisko's having to explain to them the concept of a linear existence. Because for them, the distinctions between the past, the present, and future really are just that. And well, it's not even that. It's not even an illusion. It's something that is almost beyond their ability to comprehend.
Well, I love that you brought up that example of the wormhole aliens in Deep Space Nine, the prophets, mm-hmm. because it seems to imply that Star Trek, broadly speaking, has this kind of four-dimensionalist approach to time, that from the perspective of the prophets, the future is laid out and the past, you know, it's not that the past is gone. The past exists and it's all laid out and there's no distinction between the past and the present and the future for the prophets. It's almost as if they can see events in the future. They can see events in the present. They can see events in the past. And there's no actual movement through time for the prophets. They experience all moments in time simultaneously such that they don't even understand the concept of movement through time, linear time, as they call it in the premiere episode Emissary of Deep Space Nine. So does that generally imply that Deep Space Nine has a four-dimensionalist approach? In other words, the opposite view of that, I think a slightly different opposite view would be something along the lines of thinking that the past and the future literally don't exist, right? That's another way you could go. You could just say there is no such thing as the future. Things in the future aren't real yet. Things in the past are gone. So an alternative view of time is that only the present moment is real, that the past and the future, even though we have these temporal words to describe the concepts, From the perspective of ontology, what exists and what doesn't, one explanation for this movement of time is just to say, well, the future doesn't exist and the past doesn't exist, so the problem just goes away. There is no problem of explaining the relationship between those three concepts. But that's not what's going on with the prophets in Deep Space Nine. For the prophets, the future exists, the past exists, the present exists. They don't understand movement through time, but they have access to all of them simultaneously.
Yeah, and to answer your question, I mean, yeah, I think the answer to your question is absolutely Deep Space Nine seems to have that four-dimensional kind of approach. And I think it's interesting as Star Trek has evolved over these past 50 years and as science has, in some respects, caught up with Star Trek, it's interesting to see how they have handled the ideas of space and time. But if you go back to, for instance, even the original series that gave us the concept of warp drive, I mean, isn't warp drive in its concept almost a time-traveling mechanism? Because what we're doing, we're bending space. And to go back to Einstein, you know, Einstein's theory of relativity allows for the possibility that you could warp space-time so much that you can go beyond moving faster than light, but that you could actually go off in a spaceship and return before you ever set out.
Yeah, and I'm glad you're mentioning that because I've never really understood why Star Trek doesn't try to deal with this time dilation aspect of special relativity theory at all. It essentially doesn't deal with it at all, from what I can mm-hmm. tell. Yes, you know, if there's warp drive, then you're bending space and you're kind of circumventing those relativistic effects. So it's cheating in a way. You're circumventing Einstein by positing warp drive. But sublight, you know, at impulse speeds, you know, if you're moving at some, you know, significant fraction of the speed of light at full impulse, you know, I don't know exactly what fraction of the speed of light it's supposed to be, but it's supposed to be some significant fraction of it, mm-hmm. I believe. Why aren't these time dilation effects experienced all the time? You know, you'd think timekeeping would be a big problem in the Federation insofar as starships are running around at impulse speed quite often. But, you know, generally the chronometers on different starships and back at Starfleet headquarters stay synced up, absent time travel incident like you see in Cause and Effect and elsewhere in Star Trek. But, you know, Star Trek just generally doesn't deal with that fundamental aspect of special relativity, that the faster you move, the slower time goes for you. And that's a weird concept to understand, mm-hmm. that this notion of simultaneity is related to how fast you're moving through space-time. And, you know, if you posit that space-time is malleable and the faster you move, then time moves at a different rate for you. When you really wrap your head around that, that's a hard idea to understand. You know, there should be years passing back on Earth while the Enterprise is zipping around at sublight speed, you know, chasing Romulan warbirds at impulse speed or whatever, right? Whatever they're doing. going to Ryzen not very fast on impulse speeds, whatever they do, there should be years passing back on Earth while they're zipping around at even close to the speed of light at impulse speed. But you never see them deal with that pretty much at all, I think. Am I wrong about that? Or is that just something Star Trek has just failed to deal
with? It's never dealt with it. In terms of warp drive, I think we're probably beyond the point where we're ever going to get a Star Trek that is going to explore these cerebral ideas again. I hope I'm wrong. I really sincerely hope that I'm wrong. But I seriously doubt that we're ever going to get another Star Trek that is going to be cerebral enough to explore these concepts. I think it's a tragedy that something as fundamental to Star Trek fandom as warp drive. I mean, my gosh, Zachary, we would not have Star Trek without warp drive. You're right. We would be, buzzing around our own solar system at impulse and not really exploring the great gap. We would have never made it to Vulcan or Tellor or, my goodness, Bajor. We would have never gone out to these places and discovered these strange new worlds had it not been for this technology that allows for the bending, the warping, if you will, of space-time. So I think that concept deserves a little exploration and explanation within the Star Trek universe.
Well, I don't want to turn the discussion into a referendum on science education in America, but I'm gonna get on a soapbox for just a minute, because a great many people who are actual scientists now, or engineers, or some related STEM field, right? They started as Star Trek fans, and they got introduced to these core ideas that, things like space-time, things like mm-hmm. time travel, things like, whatever technology you see in Star Trek. These can be formative ideas and educational ideas. Star Trek can be an educational tool that can introduce you to these basic concepts that if your curiosity gets piqued about them, that can influence your entire life. You might become a scientist. You might, be the next person to make a great discovery because you were exposed to something at a young age when you watched, what seemingly just an entertaining science fiction story. So when I think of Star Trek, I really think of it as an educational tool. And I would put money on the fact that if I walked around my hometown and I asked, 100 people, explained the fundamentals in the most basic level of Einstein's theory of relativity, that I would get a bunch of blank mm-hmm. stares, that most people probably can't do it. They, and this is a theory that's 100 years old, right? This isn't a brand new theory that's esoteric, exactly. that it hasn't been well established. So I would like to see Star Trek become a tool for teaching some of these basic concepts. Of course, yes, the philosophy concepts interest me, but from a purely STEM science education standpoint, what better tool for getting across these basic ideas? So, yeah, I would love to see a Star Trek story about the Enterprise, creeping up on the speed of light at sublight speeds, where they have to deal with the fact that more time passed somewhere else, and there's some consequence to that. That sounds like a fascinating Star Trek story. Even if there's a magic reset button at the end of the story where they have to undo it all, I think that's a fascinating kind of story that's never really told, because almost without fail, there's some sort of bigger brushstroke, weird time travel kind of story that has less of a basis in actual physics than something as fundamental as time dilation in the theory of relativity.
Yeah, because I would theorize that somewhere along the lines in the Star Trek universe, we've gone beyond Einstein's theory of relativity and figured out a way to warp space-time, to travel faster than the speed of light, to be able to do that without those negative consequences of time moving faster or even slower. You mentioned time moving faster, but I mean, this is a crazy universe where, there are so many inconsistencies out there in the universe. Perhaps time moves slower in some places. And we've explored these time moving at different speeds concepts within the Star Trek universe. I think Voyager did it brilliantly. But I think it is worth exploring these concepts. And you mentioned the magic reset button. Again, I would imagine that technology would have advanced to the point that we've figured out a way around the inconsistencies with time. And let's throw it out there and let's explore it. And let's push the envelope a little bit for the next generation that comes behind. I mean, we've been able to successfully transport a particle, a molecule from one place to another, you know, let's continue to push the envelope and take these concepts in new directions and inspire, you know, the next generation of thinkers.
Well, this is just some of the genius of the concept of warp drive as a plot device. You know, from a purely dramatic standpoint, there's a fundamental problem. How do you explain the fact that we can go from one star system to another in a human lifetime? Warp drive. Let's just come up with a name. We'll call it warp drive. Right? And boom, you can write your stories now. So from Gene Roddenberry's standpoint, you know, I think a lot of it was just I need a word that gets me past this problem so I can make a plausible story, right? But you know, by calling it warp drive, it's a fascinating idea because you're using these contemporary ideas, the fact that space time is malleable, to get around this more basic physics problem, not just the speed of light, but the sort of speed limit of the speed of light, but the fact that if you get anywhere close to that, there's a time difference now. Time travels at a different rate, and you know, you could spend a couple years, you know, trying to go at sublight speed and still not get very far, and you know, decades can pass back on Earth while that's going on, and so there is this physics problem behind it that warp drive solves as well. Of course, you know, there's the explanation for how warp drive works is techno babble in Star Trek, right? You don't actually get a really scientific explanation for how it works that holds up given what we know about the physical universe now. But so it works from a plot device. It also works from a physics standpoint. If something like that existed, you can get around these relativistic effects. So yeah, we don't need to tell a story about that. Let's just warp onto the next star system and tell a dramatic story. But I like those weird stories that try to take these concepts in physics or philosophy and tweak them in different ways to pull your intuitions different ways, you know, postulating what if the physical universe were like this? Let's tell a story about that. That's an interesting idea. You know, intellectually, I enjoy those. I think they're mentally stimulating and challenging and even educational for some of these core ideas in science and philosophy. And I'd like to see some of that in future Star Trek. But you know, I do want to talk about some of these actual issues in the philosophy of time. But any thoughts about you know the role of those kinds of stories in Star Trek? Or in science and philosophy and drama. And
no, like I think I've made my point clear on that regard. Like you, I'd like to start digging in a little bit to the mechanics, because when we start talking about time travel, we have to fundamentally answer the question: do the past and the future exist? Are they separate things? Is time linear? Is it only the present? You know, what do we have here? What exists and what doesn't? Is it possible to go into the past? Is the past going to be there when we get there?
You know, I think that's one of the fundamental questions to ask, because so many of these stories hinge on the notion that the past and the future exist. They're real in some way, and you can travel to them, and you can travel back from them, and there's a relationship between them. Events now will affect what unfolds in the future, and events in the past have defined the present. And, you know, that's just sort of a core understanding of our concept of time. And so, and time travel stories certainly seem to rely on something like that. It's hard to imagine a time travel story if the future literally didn't exist. How can you travel to it, right? It just doesn't add up. So I think conclusion you can draw right off the bat is that, you know, time travel depends on some notion of the future and the past being real. But one way out of the paradoxes is just to say, look, the time travel paradoxes show that the future doesn't exist and the past doesn't exist, and the only thing that's real is the present. And that is a very old traditional answer to the question of time. What is the future and what is the past, and are they real or not? One answer is just to reject the question outright and say, no, only the present is real. And that solves the time travel paradoxes. It eliminates the possibility of time travel. It solves the problem of trying to think why things in the future are real. It explains why the past seems to be gone and we don't have access to it anymore. And this was essentially the answer that St. Augustine gave when he was considering this question about time, whether the future is real and the past is real. He just rejected it outright and said, no, only the present moment is real and things change in the present moment. But, you know, the future doesn't exist yet. The past is gone. It has ceased to exist, and only the present moment is real. The problem, of course, is that it doesn't explain the movement of time and why things seem to change. The very idea that things change in time seems to imply that there's some sort of movement, at least. And so I think that answer is just hard to explain why there's change over time if the future and the past aren't real in some substantive way.
I completely understand the logic, and you and I were talking in the Turbolift, St. Augustine, said, you know, only the present is real. I'm glad you put that in the notes, because that was the, that was literally the first thing that I thought of when you and I were in the planning stages for this episode. And I tend to agree with the logic that St. Augustine put into that. And quite frankly, you know, a brilliant theologian, brilliant thinker, there's a lot of logic put into that, but you're right. There's a hand wave there, Zachary, to a lot of concepts, a lot of ideas, some of which didn't even exist in St. Augustine's time. So I tip my hat to the logic, and I tend to agree with the logic, but there's a lot of empirical science here and a lot of theoretical science that I think deserves another look. It deserves an opportunity to be seen and heard and considered when dissecting these concepts of the past and the future and the present.
Well, I think, you know, one goal of positing a theory is to try to solve problems, right? There's a paradox or something that doesn't make sense, so you posit a theory to explain that, give an answer to that. And so you can see St. Augustine's attempt to try to solve a problem, right? You know, he's examining his own life and thinking, okay, it sure seems like there's movement through time. It seems like, you know, the future doesn't, you know, the, you know, is coming into being, and it seems like the past is gone. I don't have access to either one of them. So how can that be? You know, well, they just don't exist, is his answer. The problem is, I just think it raises more problems than it solves. You know, I think a slightly deeper question about the question of time is why there seems to be movement through time at all. How is change possible? If there's literally only a present moment, no future, no past, how can anything change? Why isn't everything just static? Why isn't it that 45 minutes of a single scene of Star Trek, you know, frozen with the pause button on your television? It sure seems like in order to account for any change over time at all, there has to be some sort of movement through time. And if there's only the present moment, there's no movement through time, right? There's only one moment. How can there be movement if there isn't a future and isn't a past to move into? So I think that there's a lot of hand waving in that kind of solution, because it doesn't seem to answer this more fundamental question. How, not just, you know, why can't I access the future? Why can't I access the past? But it sure seems like moment to moment to moment, things are changing and we're moving, where there's a trajectory to it. And certainly our experience bears that out. If you just sort of phenomenally close your eyes and think, what's it like to move through time? Sure seems like things are changing all around you, and there's a trajectory to it that you can predict. And given that, that answer just doesn't seem to take into account this relatively basic phenomenon of traveling through time, and not traveling in some, you know, weird science fiction sense, but traveling through time in an ordinary sense, the passage of time and your movement from one moment of time into the next.
Again, though, what Augustine didn't have, Zachary, was the understanding of what a quantum particle is. I mean, you know, we're we're hundreds, light years from 33 light years from understanding the concepts of quantum particles when Augustine surmised that only the present is real. So again, we have to account for an expansion of understanding, and I think those concepts deserve a look and deserve to be heard. Frankly, that's one of the reasons why I enjoy a good time travel episode. I said not only do I enjoy them, you know, to be quite honest, I fancy myself a bit of a writer, an author, and, you know, I'm in the process right now of writing a time travel story about a teenage girl who discovers a small object of mythical origins. And so she and her friends are kind of thrust through this portal when they begin this adventure that'll take them from their home in the present to places through time and space that honestly never could have been imagined. And the only way that they're going to find their way back home is to locate this time traveling thief, who, by the way, happens to be
Rasmussen.
Rasmussen from
the Next Generation.
He happens to be a poet and philosopher from 700 BC Greece. And so they have to track him down. He's a time traveling thief, and he's gotten his hands on the object. They have to find him, find the object, get it in the hands of the rightful keeper, known to them only as the Guardian. So I love a good time travel story. But again, I'm cautiously optimistic, because I know the present is real. I know as it stands right now, I can't do anything about the past. And the only thing that I can do to affect the future is what I do in the present. So I tend to be boxed in by my own existence, if you will, in terms of how I view time.
This is a little bit of a tangent, but you mentioned other types of time travel stories, and you invoked a little bit of ancient Greece. One of my favorite time travel story books, a novel, is called The Plot to Save Socrates. There's a time travel story where someone goes back in time and tries to prevent Socrates from drinking the hemlock, and it's really a fascinating story.
Is that a Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure series?
Socrates, yeah. Right.
Socrates?
No. It's a great novel. And if you're looking for good time travel stories, I highly recommend that one, The Plot to Save Socrates. But a minute ago, Mike, you mentioned things like quantum mechanics. And so without question, we understand more about the natural world than we did, although there's still open theoretical questions in quantum mechanics and
absolutely
reconciling that with relativity theory. There's still plenty of theoretical work to do. But what's interesting to me about these time travel issues and the philosophy of time, the metaphysics of time, is that a lot of these issues don't seem to depend on the things science has to say about time. And that's why there's still, I think, a qualitative distinction between the philosophy of time and the physics of time, even though there's a lot of overlap. Like, for example, one of the common questions about the nature of time is the question of duration. Why does time progress at the rate that it does? You know, why is a second long? You know, why doesn't a second move faster through time? If there's movement from the past into the present, into the future, why does that seem to happen at a certain fairly predictable rate, although a malleable rate, given what we've learned about general relativity? But why, there's a kind of arbitrariness to the rate of time. Why does it pass at the rate it does and not some other rate? You know, it seems like, yeah, even if you posit there's movement through time, there's still a lot to explain. Why is it happening at that rate and not faster and not slower? It seems totally arbitrary. You can't just appeal to the fact that there's movement. You need to explain why it's moving at the rate it does, even if you grant the fact that there's movement through time.
Well, it moves at a consistent rate unless you're Baku.
Well, just because you live a long time, if you're the Baku, that doesn't mean that time is moving at a different rate, right? That's not what's that's not what's going on in that movie, right?
Indeed. But it's a great question. Why is second to second? And you mentioned the movement of time, the flow of time. So again, you're talking about quantum mechanics, understanding the nature of quantum particles, and then when you get into the nature of quantum particles, then we start having to ask the questions. Now that we at least in a elementary degree understand quantum particles, now, what can we do to change it if we know a second is a second and we know the way time flows? Can that be changed much the same way that you can create or change a wave in the ocean? The best example I can give is a still pond. And then you drop a pebble into the still pond and you create a ripple.
Gravity waves. I mean, you know, that this is the kind of thing that's positive. I mean, you hear this kind of these kinds of concepts in contemporary physics. You know, they're trying to see if they can detect gravity waves. That's essentially what you're talking about. You know, if they're the movement of matter through space-time, does that create ripples in space-time that can be detected? However faint they are, they would be awfully faint is the idea. But I read an article that I think they managed to detect gravity waves, but I could be making that up. I'm not sure I actually did read that, so don't quote me on it.
Well, and even taking that a step further, Zachary, you know, a popular theme inside of Star Trek, and we talk about the Prime Directive, but we have in Star Trek are you ready for this? It is the Temporal Prime Directive that basically prohibits the interference in the space-time continuum. You can't go back and change time. You can't do it. You're not supposed to do that.
Unless you're
Captain Kirk
or Janeway or Sisko or... So it seems like obviously the danger is great. If you learn a way to affect these concepts, yes, you know, the if space-time is malleable, then you can affect it in some way, then the
yes.
danger is great. And of course, Star Trek deals with that with concepts like the Temporal Prime Directive. But can you learn anything about that philosophically from the fact that there's a Temporal Prime Directive? Is there some lesson to be learned there that we can, you know, gives us some answer to these questions about the philosophy of time from Star Trek? That's a useful plot device because you need to put a limit on it. You can't just tell time travel stories left and right. You need that's a way of dramatically putting a limit on the types of stories you can tell, I think.
Sure, but that's, again, a plot device that I don't think, well, I more than don't think, I know that not, at least in terms of all physicists, agree upon, because if you think about quantum particles, Tim Ralph is a physicist who said, quote, "The properties of quantum particles are fuzzy or uncertain to start with. This gives them enough wiggle room to avoid inconsistent time travel situations. Our study provides insights into where and how nature might behave differently from what our theories predict." So, you know, there's some disagreement there. Can we go back? Is there wiggle room? Can we change the flow of time? Can we change an event? Or are these quantum particles so much so that there just doesn't, it just doesn't allow for those concepts to be able to exist? Even if we could go back and visit that time, can we really change it, or is it fixed? And I know that sounds a bit, and I'm a Doctor Who fan, you're not, but you know, that's a concept that we get from Doctor Who. There are events that can be changed, and then there are set points in the timeline that cannot be changed no matter what. You can't change them. They're set points.
Well, one of the things I find really interesting about quantum mechanics, and again, I'm not a physicist, but I would say I'm an educated lay person, right? Where I've you know, read enough about it and studying philosophy, and you know, on my own as an amateur, where I can speak to it a little bit intelligently. But one of the things I find fascinating is the way in which things like quantum mechanics challenge the what we seem to have learned about the universe from Einstein. So like for example, you know, with Einstein, we learned that there's a speed limit to the universe. You can't go faster than the speed of light, which means that there's no instantaneous communication. You can only communicate at the speed of light.
Correct.
Of course, in the universe, in Star Trek, you get things like subspace that give you a way around that. Of course, what is subspace? You know, technobabble. We have no idea, right? But, you know...
Well, again, I think that's a concept of somehow bending or cutting through the space-time continuum so that message can circumvent the linear nature of space and time.
Sure, exactly. I mean, without a doubt, that's what its intention is. But in the real world, we've sort of learned, you know, as far as we know, there's a sort of maximum speed limit of the universe, the speed of light, positing warp drive, ignoring subspace, you know, than in the real world. But with things like quantum mechanics, you get things like instantaneous communication between particles. Like, I don't know if you're familiar with the concept of quantum entanglement, the way in which two particles that are sort of generated at the same time, and their total spin, you know, they have these various properties like spin and charm, and the, you know, these particles that these properties that sound, they're just arbitrary names for these numerical quantitative properties that these particles have. But if two particles have a total spin that's known and they're separated even over great distances, then as one particle is measured, and this is what's weird and quirky about quantum mechanics, that the very act of measuring can collapse the particle's wave function and define the numerical properties that mm-hmm. particle has. So if two particles are generated and then you measure one of them, hence collapsing its wave function, fixing these quantities like how much spin it has, then the total amount of spin between these two particles has to add up. And even if you measure it on the other side, the two particles will have a total known amount of spin, even though they couldn't have communicated across this great distance, because the communication would have to be faster than the speed of light. So in these really isolated cases, that they don't seem to be macroscopic, these seem to be microscopic instances of, you know, just single particles or pairs of particles, then it seems like you're getting something that violates Einstein's restriction on instantaneous communication. And so that the one of the fundamental problems in physics, at least, how to reconcile these two things, right? How do you reconcile these concepts from Einstein, space time, universal speed limit, you know, not going faster than the speed of light, problems with simultaneity, and how do you reconcile that with these weird, quirky events that you can observe at the micro level with quantum mechanics? So there even when contemporary physics, you can see violations of these concepts, though. You know, if Einstein says there's a you can't communicate faster than the speed of light. You could imagine a communication rig where, you know, some sort of futuristic Morse code, right? Where you're tweaking a particle over here and causing some other particle to do something over here instantaneously, violating the restriction on the on not communicating faster than the speed of light. So it's not about time travel, but it is an interesting attempt to try to wrestle with this concept of time. What's essential there as it relates to time? Is Einstein right that there's a speed limit, that you can't go faster, that simultaneity is relative to these various things like movement and gravity and whatnot? Or can you violate those rules in these quirky quantum mechanics situations? Could you imagine a machine that, you know, makes use of that, where you tweak something over here and something else happens, you know, light years away because these two particles are entangled? Could you communicate faster than light because of this quantum entanglement? It would be a mistake to think that contemporary physics has figured all of that out. These are still open theoretical issues in physics.
Oh, absolutely.
And there's so much interesting room for taking those things that don't add up in physics itself and writing those into Star Trek. I would love to see, you know, some Star Trek stories, as long as they're still dramatically, and I don't want just, you know, a science lesson in Star Trek. I want it to be good Star Trek stories. But I would love to see a Star Trek story that hinges on something that's ultra relevant in the physics of you know, whether it's relativistic physics or quantum physics as it relates to time. I think that would be an interesting challenge in how to write a story that takes those really contemporary concepts and issues and tensions in science into account.
Yeah. And as it stands right now, Zachary, I mean, we're still experimenting with subatomic particles that we don't, at least at this point, we don't even have the beginnings of understanding the nature of. And so we're decades away. And I don't want to be the party pooper, as it were, but I think we're decades away from being anywhere near the capabilities of being able to begin to develop something like a warp drive, or really being able to transport somebody, even beginning to think about the concept of time travel. I mean, we don't even really understand how time flows and why it only flows in one direction. I don't recall the name of the physicist, but the theory was that just as you can change the direction of airflow by literally changing the direction of the fan that's moving it, you know, what if it were possible to, at least in terms of time, to be able to create something in the terms of a time fan, if you will, that could change the direction of these subatomic particles and move them in a different direction? Is that how we can move from the present to the past, by changing or to accelerate ourselves into the future by somehow changing the flow of these subatomic particles? Again, it's all theoretical. It's all experimental. We're not even ready to begin to really deal with those things, because we're still trying to understand the most minute concepts of these subatomic particles.
Mike, do you remember that episode of The Next Generation called Timescape, in which you know, the characters are on a Romulan warbird, and you see an instance of time starting to go in reverse, right? At mm-hmm. a certain point, time gets reversed and all the characters start walking backwards, and then all of a sudden, you know, the switch gets flipped forward again and time starts moving forward. And of course, in the story, there's a Romulan that's not where he's supposed to be, and they figure out it's really an alien and whatnot. But you do see time moving backwards in Star Trek. Not very often, but that's an episode that comes to mind where you actually see a reversal of the direction of time. Mm-hmm. And that's interesting to me because there is this arbitrariness to the direction of time. Why does time always seem to flow in one direction? We've never observed it going backwards. It's like you said, there's some theoretical postulations for how you might cause that, but nothing that could be empirically verified, or nothing anyone has experienced. But there's an arbitrary, it's just like there's an arbitrariness to the rate of time, you know, the rate at which time travels. Why is a second just a second? Why does time only seem to move one direction when the equations sure seem to allow that it could go the other direction? There's an arbitrariness to why it goes one direction and not the other. Why didn't we start with the Big Crunch instead of the Big Bang, you know, in terms of the origin of the universe? These are questions that are hard to answer because all we have is the empirical data before us. Sure, it just seems like it moves one direction and there's no deep reason why. But I think that's another interesting question about the mechanics of time, temporal mechanics. Why is there a priority towards one direction of time versus, you know, the reverse direction?
Yeah, indeed. And, you know, Zachary, when you talk about going back in time, and we've already kind of touched on this, I want to sort of go there again. You know, if we were able to move backwards in time, or even more so, to be able to take ourselves from one distinct point in time and move to another distinct point in time in the past, it's been theorized that in order to do that, you would literally be going into another universe, because as soon as you arrive at the past, you're making a choice and there'll be a split, so that our universe won't be affected by anything that you do in the past. And that particular theory comes from a theoretical physicist named Ronald Mallet. And I think Mallet raises an interesting point there, because when we talk about time travel, and certainly we explore this quite often in the Star Trek universe, again, I mentioned the temporal prime directive, you know, going back and changing a moment in time. And we, again, lots of examples of this. I think probably my first best example is going to be City on the Edge of Forever. You know, Edith Keeler must die. And so if you go back and you change that, how does it affect the future? I think about the animated episode Yesteryear, Spock going back and, you know, essentially, you know, changing history, as it were, because of his actions. And the list goes on and on and on and on. Literally, there are dozens of examples in these 51 Star Trek episodes of how actions in the past, you know, created some type of divergence, as it were, and some change, some measurable change happened in the future. Of course, oftentimes when the temporal investigators show up, you're trying to prove that no, we didn't make any changes. And of course, the answer is always, well, how do you know? How do you know? But this idea that no, if you go back in the past, whatever you do isn't going to have any effect on this universe, because in order to do that, you're not just going through time, Zachary, you're going into an entirely other universe.
Yeah, I think we'd be remiss if we didn't spend a little time talking about this branching theory of time, that events happen, that, you know, different branches all exist simultaneously, that you can be on one branch or another. If you go back in time, you're essentially shifting, you know, things onto a different branch, all of which exist in some way. Mm-hmm. And I think what's interesting is that you can give both a sort of a physics-based justification for that idea, and you can give a philosophical-based justification for that idea. And whether that proves to be true or not, you know, I think it's still an open question. That's why we're still talking about it. But, for the physics-based justification, you know, we seem to have learned from quantum mechanics that at least at the micro level, at the level of subatomic particles, that the nature of those particles aren't defined until they're observed, right? You know, particles have a wave function that is collapsed in the act of observation. So really, a particle can be in a state of quantum flux, pardon the Star Trek sounding term, in which, you know, the particle could be in a certain state or be in a different state, and you don't know which it is. In fact, you could say that it's in all of them simultaneously until that wave function gets collapsed and gets a definite value. Whether that microscopic uncertainty manifests itself at a macro level, at the level of macroscopic objects that are bigger than subatomic particles, I think is still an open question. I think it's a very interesting theoretical question whether that indeterminacy is restricted solely to the quantum level, or whether it manifests itself at this macroscopic larger world that we seem to live in. So that's the sort of physics-based justification, the idea that different future states are all possible states until there's kind of a collapsing of the wave function, one of them becomes the actual path that you're on. The philosophy-based justification, I think, is just because the idea of branching time solves these time travel paradoxes. If you can go back in time and change things without destroying your own timeline, the kinds of change that we see in Star Trek 2009, going back in time and, you know, time gets on a different branch and the old timeline still exists, we're just not on that branch anymore. It avoids these kinds of grandfather time travel paradoxes, you know, shooting your own grandfather and and eliminating your own existence.
Exactly.
You know, like the kinds of things you see in Back to the Future, the Back to the Future paradox, right? What if you go back in time and your parents don't meet and you don't exist anymore to go back in time? Mm-hmm. Those kinds of just basic, you know, science fiction 101 kinds of.
I think Fury is probably a really good Star Trek example of that, where Kes goes back in time and Janeway ends up having to kill her. She has to end her life in order to save the ship. And so what's Janeway's grand solution to this? So we're going to get present Kes to record a message for future Kes so that we don't have to repeat these events. And, you know, Janeway doesn't have to kill, 9-year-old angry Kes.
Yeah, and of course, you know, that doesn't take into account this branching idea. That's still restricted to this fairly linear sense of time travel,
yes.
The traditional time travel stories. And, you know, Star Trek 2009 relies on this branching theory of time. And I think, you know, if you can solve a paradox by saying, well, what if time works this way? What if time branches? And that solves the time travel paradox. Philosophically, if you've solved a paradox, that's a reason to think it's true, right? Because you solved the problem. It must be true. Otherwise, we'd still have the problem. So it's an interesting case where, you know, you get some philosophical justification for it, and you're also getting some physics-based justification for it. Does that mean it's true? Well, it probably depends how the science pans out. I'm not a physicist, so I don't really know, but it's at least a feather in its cap. It's a reason to prefer that notion of time versus the more linear, traditional time travel 101 kinds of concepts of time.
I think about great time travel episodes. It's funny, Janeway, who always said she would stay away from time travel, I think probably did more time traveling than anybody. I think about Future's End and Future's End Part 2, in which we somewhat discover that the technology that we take for granted here in the current computer age is actually something that came to us from the future. You know, when Captain Braxton's time ship was captured after it crash landed in the past, and then we get the current computer revolution, and of course, you know, that you kind of have this causal effect of, you know, all of the technology that leads up to eventually the future. And so, you know, what do you do with that? Do you change that? Do you leave it the same? What do you do with it? I think we deal with these concepts in really interesting ways. They're inconsistent throughout the Star Trek universe. I kind of like that branching idea that you and I were talking about, this concept that you're going into another universe and therefore you can't really, you use the example, and I know that's the popular philosophical example, go in the past and shoot your grandfather. That idea of another universe and that effect not having any kind of repercussions in our current timeline, you know, certainly I think is something interesting. You mentioned Star Trek 2009, you hit the nail on the head. And I think for everyone out there, you know, listeners of our podcast that aren't particularly fans of the Kelvin timeline, I think are all cheering right now at this idea of this branching theory, because, you know, they can still play in their wonderful playground of the Prime Universe. And, you know, JJ had no effect on that.
Yeah, it's a temporal get out of jail free card, right?
It's a wonderful thing.
You can violate all the rules you want, and you can not destroy your original timeline. You can change anything you like, and that's essentially what happened in Star Trek 2009. You know, let's destroy Vulcan. Let's go back in time. Let's make these major changes, and, you know, fans of the original timeline can be happy because all that's still intact, and we've just given ourselves a totally different playground where we can violate whatever rules we want, and there are no consequences for the Prime timeline.
So, Zachary, we've rolled past an hour at this point, and we probably should be starting to wrap up our discussion, but I know we still have a couple of quick things that we want to throw in relative to the physics of time.
Well, Mike, from the perspective of the philosophy of time, I think there's two important things that we haven't talked about yet to take into account, or at least mention. I mean, I think we'd be remiss if we didn't mention them as we're talking about the philosophy of time. One is the disagreement or the debate between these two relatively obscure philosophers, unless you're interested in the metaphysics and the philosophy of time. One is J.M.E. McTaggart, and the other is Henri Bergson, the French philosopher Henri. It's why it's spelled like Henry, but it's Henri. McTaggart basically held that subjective time, this sense that we're observing ourselves moving through time. You know, when we sort of examine the phenomena of our own life, we feel like we're moving through time, right? That's part of our sensory phenomenal experience. Basically, he held that that's an illusion, that the past and the future are laid out in this fixed membrane, and that any sense of movement through time is totally illusory. That when you sort of step back and look at it metaphysically, kind of from the perspective of the prophets in Deep Space Nine, mm-hmm. any sense of movement has to just be an illusion, because the past is where it is, and the future is where it is, and each slice of that time is just a different present moment. So there's no movement along that membrane. So our sense is somehow an illusion. It doesn't really explain why it seems like there's movement along it. It sure seems to ignore the phenomenal quality of our experience. But that's one answer to the question, is just to reject the notion that there is movement through time at all, and that four-dimensionalist view of the past and the future being laid out all in an orderly membrane, for lack of a better word, is one attempt to solve the problem. But an interesting counterpoint to that is this view of the philosopher Bergson, who basically had the exact opposite view, that only subjective time is real, that any attempt to kind of quantify or abstract time, any attempt to measure time, any attempt to provide a philosophical account of what time is, all of those are abstractions from our first person experience, and different ways of measuring time. This is part of the reason you see that different cultures have different temporal systems, different ways of measuring time, different tools for measuring time, whether it's sands in the hourglass, like Days of Our Lives, or whether it's an atomic clock, whatever you see in Star Trek. However, Data's internal chronometer works, right? We don't really know, but all of those are just abstractions from the first person experience of movement through time. So he actually rejects the idea that time is something objective at all. He actually prioritizes the first person experience, very much like you'd expect from an empiricist philosopher like David Hume. It's in that radically empiricist tradition, prioritizing our experience and thinking that everything else is derivative of that. All of the theories of time, all the ways of measuring time, none of those are as real as our first person experience. So that's one really important distinction. Is this movement through time real or not? Is the movement of time purely subjective, an illusion because of this four-dimensionalist view? Or is the subjective, our experience of time, the first-person subjective experience, what we know more fundamentally than any of these sort of intellectual, mathematical abstractions of time? The last thing I want to mention about the philosophy of time before we wrap up, and I would be really remiss if we didn't include a reference to Immanuel Kant. Kant! You know, we keep coming back to Kant, and you can't avoid a discussion of time unless you talk about Kant a little bit. Mainly because Kant had such a fundamentally, radically different view of almost anything we've talked about the nature of time. Almost every philosopher we've talked about, every view, every scientific theory, in some way posits that time is real. It's just a matter of interpreting what it is, giving an analysis that tries to explain what it is, explaining why it has the properties that it has, the direction and the movement and the rate of time and whatnot. Kant had a totally different view. Basically, his view is that we really fundamentally don't know the way that things really are in themselves. He's a total skeptic about our ability to understand reality in itself, what he called things in themselves. But we do seem to experience this fairly objective reality in terms of space and time that we can measure, that we can make rational judgments about. So his answer is basically that our mind, our rational structures that we have that are innate and objective, and they really are only work a certain way. Logic only works a certain way. Mathematics only works a certain way. These are sort of innate rational qualities that we have. That these things are structures within which we experience whatever reality really is. So it's almost like they're filters through which reality gets perceived through, and that we're on the other end of the filters. We're perceiving reality in terms of space, in terms of time, in terms of these various rational and logical and mathematical judgments that we can make about reality. It's as if the notion of space and time are like sunglasses that we can't take off. You know, that reality is an unintelligible jumble of whatever reality really is. And he has no judgments at all about whatever reality is, because we can't help but experience reality in terms of space and in terms of time. Mm-hmm. And we can't help but make judgments except in terms of mathematics and logical reasoning and whatnot. So basically, he's saying that time, our perception of time, is a structure that's imposed by our mind on whatever inputs we're getting from reality in itself, the way things really are in some deep metaphysical way. That, you know, he's just a total skeptic. He thinks we can't get outside of these structures. It's like a pair of sunglasses you can't take off. You don't know what reality is really like outside of the sunglasses, right? So he basically thinks time is not out there somewhere. It's not something that is real. It's something that our minds are imposing on reality in some way. And so it's no accident that we're perceiving reality in terms of time, because our mind is doing the structuring and the ordering and the intelligizing that allows us to perceive reality in an orderly way. But there's no way of knowing whether that time is real or not, if it's out there in the real world, apart from our experience of that time. But what's interesting for Kant is he's not saying that it's subjective. You might think, oh, well, Kant's just saying time is subjective, right? It's something our minds are adding. Kant is really interesting because he thinks that there's a necessity, like a logical, rational necessity to these structures. Time is ordered in a certain way, and space works in a certain way, and our logical and mathematical reasoning work in a certain way. And all of us are making the same exact judgments about reality in that way. Our minds work logically and rationally in the same way. So all of us experience time in the same way. I experience it in the same direction that you do. I make the same kinds of judgments and the same kinds of measurements about time that you do. But it's not because time is real and objective and out there somewhere. Mm-hmm. It's because all of our minds are imposing the same kinds of structures on whatever reality really is. So it's a really interesting middle ground, because he's saying that time is, it's not objective. It's not out there in the real world. It's not real in some deep metaphysical sense, but it's not subjective and open to interpretation either. It's objective in the sense that there's a rational, logical necessity to it that our minds are imposing. We just have no way of knowing whether that is also true in reality in itself, or whether it's something that our mind is just imposing on reality. There's literally no way to know, because we can't get outside of these rational structures that define the way our minds operate. So he's a skeptic about time as reality. So Kant is interesting, because almost everyone else thinks that time is real in some way, and Kant is a total skeptic about whether time is real or not, but he doesn't think it's subjective. He still thinks it's something objective that you can measure, that you can do science about, and so he's also not rejecting this attempt to explain scientifically and mathematically why time is the way it is. It's still something we can do research on, we can measure, and we can experiment on. He's not rejecting modern science. In fact, he's trying to preserve modern science from all of these skeptical worries. So he's found an interesting way to kind of have your cake and eat it too. He gives the skeptics all of their assumptions. Yeah, we don't really know how reality is, and he's a skeptic, but he also, because of that, doesn't think that we have to reject science, because he thinks that these concepts like space and time and number and logical reasoning, those are sort of a priori or prior to our experience, and they're the categories within which our experience gets structured. So yeah, we can do all the science we want. You know, despite all those skeptical worries, he thinks science can plug along just fine and reach plenty of objective judgments about the world that we experience, which is structured in terms of time.
And so in this regard, Zachary, Immanuel Kant kind of lives up to our meme, our little gag that we have with Captain Kirk shouting Con or Kant, because in terms of Immanuel Kant's position, you're absolutely right. He's somewhat opposed to basically everyone else out there. He stands alone as an island in this idea, and certainly Star Trek rejects this notion as well, and for all intents and purposes maroons Immanuel Kant and his idea on SETI Alpha 4. But I like the idea that his theory, it does present a way in which you can have your cake and you can eat it too. But I think to reject the idea that time in and of itself is not a thing, it doesn't exist. I think most every that certainly isn't my intuition, and I don't know too many people that their intuitions are going to go in that direction. So, you know, I think we established in that right, at least in common thought, that time is a thing. It's measurable. It's quantifiable.
Well, I think I think there's a really common misunderstanding of Kant, and I think maybe you just made a mistake in interpreting Kant that is very, very common to make, because I think the move that he makes is really subtle. He's not saying time isn't real. He's saying it's not metaphysically real. It's not reality in itself in some deep metaphysical, you know, the fundamental nature of reality kind of way. He's saying time is real. It's just that what that means is that our phenomena, our experience, is in terms of time, which is objective and we can measure it. It's that our mind is active in structuring our experience, but it structures it in such a logical, objective, structured way that the end result, the world that we experience, the everyday world with, you know, all the sensory inputs that we get and all the things we experience, are structured rigidly in terms of time that is real and is objective that we can measure. So it's not saying time isn't real and it doesn't exist. He's saying it's not sort of metaphysically real. We have no way of getting outside of our experience to ask that deeper question about whether time is a real deep part of the universe in some way. But he's not rejecting the idea that all over the world we experience, that we live in, that we make judgments about, that we do perform scientific experiments on, that ordinary world of experience is I don't want to say deeply because that sounds metaphysical, but it's structured in terms of time and it's objective. So we can measure it and we can do our science and we get all the benefits of time as something objective without having to posit this deeper metaphysical idea that the reality in itself in some deep metaphysical way has time as a part of it. So it is kind of having your cake and eating it too. So you got to be careful, because he's not rejecting the notion of time. He's just saying time isn't a metaphysical concept. Time is a part of the world of experience, which is the phenomena of our experience, and all of the phenomena seem to be structured in terms of time. So you can do all the science we want on the world of experience and learn a lot of things about the world that we experience, the ordinary world that we live in, that we have experiences of and make judgments about. He's just saying we can't know metaphysically whether that's a real deep part of the universe or not.
Well, evidently I've made two errors, because it just occurred to me that I said SETI Alpha 4. It was actually SETI Alpha 5.
Oh, well, that's the big error.
And I'm still leaving this concept of Kant's there on SETI Alpha 5.
Well, I think, you know, what's interesting about Kant in general, of course, is this, and he's really kind of a linchpin in the history of philosophy, where, you know, almost everyone up till Kant just takes the world for granted. You know, they might be a skeptic, but in some way they tend to think that the world is out there and it's real and it's different from us and it's somehow, and we can learn about it and it's out there. Kant is really kind of saying, no, the world we experience, our mind is active in constructing the world that we experience. It's not just something we passively receive. Our mind is playing an active role in shaping the world that we experience. And that is such a fundamental idea. And from Kant in the history of philosophy, that idea branches off in a lot of really different ways. You know, you get these radical subjective people like Nietzsche. You get the phenomenologists who try to get back to the world of experience. But it all stems from this idea that our mind is active in constructing the world we experience. And Kant is really the first person in the history of philosophy to come along and say, the world is not something we just passively receive. Our minds are doing something in shaping the world that we experience. And of course, Kant thinks it's something objective. He thinks, yeah, we're active. We're the ones who define reality that we experience in terms of space and in terms of time and in terms of these other qualities that we can make judgments about. Mm-hmm. But it's not that the world is out there that we passively receive. He's a total skeptic about what reality is like and what's out there apart from our experience. But that doesn't make him subjective. Doesn't mean he's rejecting the concept of time. You know, it doesn't mean he's rejecting science, anything like that. It's just that he's thinking that our minds are the ones that are imposing that structure on the things we experience.
So in terms, Zachary, my final thoughts, when we're talking about time, you know, T'Pol said that the Vulcan science directorate has determined that time travel could not possibly exist. And I wouldn't go that far. I certainly think it's possible. We mentioned St. Augustine, and I'm going to kind of wrap up by going back to the beginning of our discussion. St. Augustine saying only the present is real. And again, I question not his logic, but rather the limited scientific evidence that he had at the time. But theologically speaking, it's interesting because your average theologian feels that time is a fixed thing. It is created. It flows in one direction because that's the way it was instituted. Time began at a certain point, and it has a certain end, and it flows in one singular direction. It's linear. And that's where probably most theologians are going to fall. So in terms of what Augustine said, I think that represents, by and large, the opinions of most theologians. However, I think through the course of the Bible, you and I were talking in the turbo lift, it's interesting because there are actually a couple of instances in the Bible where many lovers of theology, such as myself, see instances in which time travel happens in Scripture, and God is able to circumvent time and travel through time and permit the moving from, you know, past, future, present. And I find those concepts very interesting. And, you know, whether this is something that only God can master, or if it's a science that, you know, a flesh and blood human being like you and I can master, I think only time will tell. I think science is definitely leading in an interesting direction. And to just kind of bring this all back to Trek, it's the thing that I love about Star Trek is that we are willing to explore these concepts in an intelligent way. And even in those instances, Zachary, where we wave a hand to this or we ignore that, or we don't do a very good job explaining a certain concept or idea, I think the fact that we dream in intelligent directions, I think says a lot for why Star Trek for 50 years has really driven to some degree the sciences. And I think it'll continue to drive the sciences as long as we continue to tell intelligent stories that find their basis in science and theory and are willing to push these concepts, to push the scientific envelopes and dream a little in an intelligent way. So I'm very optimistic. I'm skeptical when it comes to time travel, you know, kind of bringing it back to cause and effect. You know, I love the idea that, you know, there's a possibility that perhaps, you know, a message, even a short message like the number 3 signifying Commander Riker's pips, that simple message can be sent back in time and be interpreted in such a way that it prevents a future calamity from happening. I find that concept really interesting and really exciting, and I think it's worth exploration, both in terms of science fiction and science fact. You know, can we send a message in a bottle, so to speak, to the past? You know, certainly we can do it to the future. And what we're doing right now, Zachary, who knows, maybe a generation from now, somebody will be listening to this and go, you know, wow, if those guys only knew then what we know now, how exciting would that be? That's really my final thoughts. I'm intrigued by the concept. I love the stories inside of Star Trek. The philosophy is fascinating. It's been a fun discussion.
Well, Mike, with your theological interest in the nature of time, are you saying that it's the wormhole aliens that define the rate of time, why a second proceeds at the rate it does? Or maybe it could be Q just as well, but, you know, that's one answer, that some supernatural being is, you know, is defining the rate of time, you know, from outside time is defining the rate at which time flows. And then you have to ask, well, okay, well, how come, you know, if those creatures seem to have experiences and interact in a certain way, what, why does time seem to flow at a certain rate for them? Some sort of meta time and so on and so forth. But that's my working theory. It's the wormhole aliens that have defined the rate of time. I think we solved the problem.
Well, in all truth and all seriousness, Zachary, to some degree, I mean, that is the common thought among theologians. You know, whether you define God as an infinite immortal being, or, you know, whether you see God in terms of, you know, just some alien who is able to operate and exist in ways using technologies and abilities that, you know, are just beyond our concept, or, you know, whether you ignore the idea of God altogether, that's a personal choice. But the interesting thing that you said there is, you know, did the wormhole aliens define time? And so for theologians, that is the answer, that time is something that's fixed and defined and has been set in motion. It has a set beginning and a set end, and it flows at a consistent rate.
I only said that, half tongue in cheek, because if you do have a theological worldview, then that is your answer, that, you know, whatever created the universe is what set those things in motion and, you know, defined the fundamental constants. And, you know, if you have a theological view, then a theological answer is permissible. It's not necessarily a philosophical answer. It's not a logical answer in some strict sense, but it's at least a rational answer based on a worldview that is coherent or not to various degrees. But for my final thoughts, I think, you know, I'm a little disappointed at the state of science fiction as it relates to time and time travel stories. I think with this many subtopics and this many nuances in the discussion of the metaphysics and the physics of time, things like why time moves at the rate it does, why it only seems to flow in one direction, whether the future exists or whether it doesn't exist, whether it's subject time is real or subjective, or whether time is purely a mental construct, all the physics discussions we've had, you know, the distinction between Newtonian physics and relativistic physics, the tension between relativistic physics and quantum mechanics, you know, there's so many subtopics to the physics and the metaphysics of time. There's just no excuse for boring time travel stories. You know, every time travel story should have some new take on this discussion, given how many nuances there are and how many unanswered questions there are about the nature of time. I hope that in our discussion tonight, we've at least exposed some of the things that people may have thought about with time in some sort of structured way. I think almost anyone who's bothered to think about what time really is has had thoughts along these lines in one way or another. Why does time only seem to move the way it does? Why doesn't time go faster or slower? Why doesn't time go backwards? How is time related to space? You know, whatever these questions are, you know, anyone who's mused about time in any way, shape, or form has probably thought of all of these. Except when you put them all together, you start to realize how little we actually understand about time. Even given everything we've learned about the natural world from Einstein and from quantum mechanics, these are a plethora of open questions, and they're all really interesting and fascinating. And if you're not interested in this kind of abstract metaphysics or physics, you know, this is not going to be a terribly interesting discussion. But if you're even a little intellectually curious about reality and why it is the way it is, this should be an interesting discussion, and it's fun to see how these different kinds of concepts and different kinds of questions manifest themselves for us inside the Star Trek universe, right? You know, we enjoy seeing stories that expose these kinds of questions and allow your mind to entertain a different way of thinking about the nature of time or space or reality. I think that's part of Star Trek storytelling, that if you're not paying attention to it, it's easy to miss and easy to underappreciate. So stories like Cause and Effect that bend a time travel story in a different kind of way, just I swell with anticipation for those kinds of stories. I love those stories. They speak to me intellectually, and they speak to my imagination in a deep way. So I think, Mike, in closing, I think my fundamental point is just that I hope our listeners have learned something about how little we really know. Even despite everything we've learned, so much is left unknown, and there's so many open questions. And if you're even a little bit intellectually curious, this should stimulate your imagination. If you want to understand reality and learn what reality is really like in any meaningful way. And for me, personally, I think these questions of time get more salient the older I get. And I don't know if you're a little older than I am, Mike. I don't know if you experienced this.
You don't remind
too.
Me.
The older I get, yeah, you're a few years older, right? I'm not going to say how many. 33 years older. You're not 33 years older. But the older I get, the more I find, you know, I'm like, you know, creeping up on midway through life's journey here, to use a quote from Dante's Inferno, right? When you're 20, you don't think about time so much. You think you got all the time in the world. It's not your main focus. You know, as I get older and older, as the years and decades start to go by, I find myself dwelling on these kinds of issues more, because, you know, you realize you only have so many years in this life, and you kind of realize, well, why is that? Why do I only get to live 100 years? Why is 100 years, you know, the rate that it passes at? Why can't I go back and change things in the past? And, you know, you wish you could do those things, and you wish you could, change the nature of reality. And you realize how utterly futile it is to dwell on those things, because, you know, we don't have that ability and we can't seem to travel through time. And, you know, these kinds of time travel stories are empowering. They're great for the imagination. On the other hand, they're a really stark contrast to reality as it's lived for most of us. We don't have the ability to travel through time. I can't stop time. I can't change the rate of time. Time is this predator, to use a mm-hmm. quote from Star Trek, that stalks us all our lives. You know, we can't do anything about it. We are a little bit helpless. And I think there's this deep-seated human need to try to master time, to tame that beast, and you know, become the master of our own lives. And we fundamentally aren't able to do that. And that's an interesting paradox of human life, given everything we've learned, and of course, given how many open questions there are. So I like stories that simultaneously play on the philosophy and the science, but also have this human element. You know, there is this race against time in human life, and time travel stories that don't invoke the race against time ring a little hollow to me. You know, as I get a little older, stalking nature of time that troubles me more and more.
Well, Zachary, I am a little bit older than you, and I rather think of time as a companion.
Well, it's because you're 33 years older than I am, you know?
You know, you said that you hoped that today's episode, all threes, will stimulate the imaginations of our listeners. And yeah, certainly. And at the very least, I hope it stimulates some good fanfic. Maybe we can put St. Augustine on a time ship and move him through time. Before we close out, I thought of something. You mentioned the wormhole aliens a moment ago, and it occurs to me that while my leanings do tend to go towards the theological aspects and ideas, my mind is open, very open to the science. And, if you're very optimistic, as most of us Star Trek fans are, there are string theorists out there who believe that wormhole openings can not only be a shortcut from one point in space to another, but literally a shortcut from one moment in time to another. So, you know, who knows, as we explore the sciences, if we can get our space program back into high gear and boldly go and explore and learn, who knows, we might find a wormhole out there that would challenge all of our ideas on the concepts of time and space and fuel yet another generation of imagination. Well, Zachary, it's been fun talking about cause and effect and the metaphysics of time, but this isn't the only thing that we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week, so here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Ready Room.
You know, Star Trek All Access gives you a great acronym, though.
Star!
Star, yeah.
Yes.
Star!
Yeah, the upward angle on the... Yeah, totally get it.
The orb.
I don't know if obsessive love is really love, because it's... I think it's more about possession. Yeah, and for Dukat, she's a possession of his, not really a relationship of his.
The 602 Club.
I loved that first volume, the 3-minute format. I was highly skeptical about it. Tartakovsky, I believe, was in Star Wars Insider. They had an interview with them where they were like, oh, this is bold, you know, 3 minutes. How did this come about? And I remember very specifically, because I was stunned.
And introducing Stage 9, a podcast about the people who make Star Trek.
Had the story brewing in my head for a long time, but I eventually realized it was a beautiful fit for this project, and it turned out to be the right fit.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe, your favorite time of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us tremendously, and it makes it much easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, no problem. We've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course, you can always stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Another way you can help us keep all our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find all our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all of the really great perks that we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and many, many more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise Orbiter will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can help make it happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org and find out more and get your seat on the mission. If you'd like to contact us with feedback or suggestions for the show, or to send us your thoughts on anything that we've discussed in this episode of MetaTreks, you can contact us in several different ways. You can contact us via a form. Just go to trek.fm/contact.
If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, you can look in the sidebar on our show page on the Trek FM website, or just go to speakpipe.com/trekfm.
You can also find us on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @TrekFM.
On Facebook, you can find us at facebook.com/TrekFM and find us in the Babel Conference, Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group. Just type Babel into the search field on Facebook. That's B-A-B-E-L. Or go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar.
We'd also like to invite you to leave a rating and review of MetaTreks on iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback and suggestions for the show. Well, Zachary, when you're not trying to escape the Typhon Expanse, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
Well, you can find me in Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group, the Babel Conference, and Facebook, and you can also find me on Twitter. My handle there is just my name, @ZacharyFruhling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, Fruhling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. And Mike, when you're not planning our next All Threes episode of MetaTreks, MetaTreks episode 333... where can people find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
I have 33 ideas for that, by the way. They can find me on Facebook always. That's where I'm most active, and around the Babel Conference. On Twitter, my handle is @CMichael1701. I'm also on Instagram, CMichael1701. Well, Zachary, we'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the MetaTreks team from around the network. Specifically, we'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, founder and publisher of Trek.fm. Also, our executive producers, Charlene Schmidt, Matthew Rushing, and Norman Lau. Aaron Harvey, our art director. Will Wynn, our content manager. And the guy that works every single day for Trek FM, our production manager, Richard Marquez. We'd also like to give a shout out to our associate producers, Patrick Devlin. You can connect with Patrick on Twitter. His Twitter handle is @MagicDrop5. And also Kay Elizabeth Janeway. You can find her on Twitter as well, @ChocoWeeble. Thank you so much for your support of MetaTreks and for Trek FM. And thank you, everybody, for listening to MetaTreks, a Star Trek philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.